Hi, this is session three of Dan Lewis's mini course on crime and justice, trying to get to some notion of general justice, and since we're on session three, we ought to be closing in on it pretty soon. I want to talk a little bit today about prison, and for those of you who haven't been to all of these, take a couple of seconds to just show you what kind of the main emphasis has been in the way we've gone about looking at crime. The top figure for any given crime, robbery, burglary, whatever, was 100% of the amount of that crime committed in any jurisdiction. We were using national figures when I went through this at the beginning of the week. Roughly speaking, of the 100% of the crimes that are committed, about 30% are reported. Okay, that is to say, a citizen calls the police, tells them that it happens, or a policeman actually saw the incident. If it's a crime of violence, this figure is higher. If it's a property crime, this figure is lower. But 30% will give you a basic sense of what's going on. And roughly, out of that 30%, about 6% of those crimes end in an arrest, where the policeman actually picks somebody up and they're arrested for that crime. About half of those people go to court, and about 1% end up in prison. And what we've been talking about over the last three sessions is we've looked at the police a little bit, we've looked at the arresting a little bit, and we've talked about this dilemma, which is that when you look at these figures, you're struck by the fact that the criminal justice system, which starts about here, even if it did a terrific job on trying to reduce the amount of crime, it's got a long way to go in order to make a dent in this figure up here and make a dent in the most important piece of doing something about the crime problem, which is people reporting it. So that if on a good day, we can improve the number of arrests and hopefully improve the number of people that are in prison, even if we did twice as good as we're doing today, it's only 2%, 3%, or 4%, that's a long way from having an effect on the total amount of crime in the society. And the other thing that we talked about a little bit was the idea of deterrence, which is how most people in the criminal justice system think about reducing crime. That is to say, if you make it sure that someone is going to be punished for the crime that they do, and if you make that punishment severe, that's going to reduce the crime problem. So that if we can get more people in prison, there's more punishment, and it comes fast, and it's severe, hopefully that's going to knock down this number. And I talked last time about the fly in that ointment, which is the problem of information. And then when you look at the amount of information that the police have in solving most crimes, unless they're at the scene almost immediately, unless it's a crime in which the person is assaulted or hurt by someone that they know and can tell who it is, it's very, very hard for the police to have the information to make the arrest that would lead to the severe punishment. And then we talked a little bit about the court system and how many of the total number of people that are arrested don't really get to court, and if they do get to court, often there's a plea bargaining situation where they will plead guilty to a lesser charge, which then makes, at least in their mind, some confusion about whether they're serving time for what they did or for the best deal they could get. And finally tonight, before I get into some of the kind of more positive kinds of things that we can do about it, I want to tell you a little bit about this bottom figure and give you some figures to sort of complete the picture of the limited capacities of the criminal justice system in dealing with these problems. Since 1979, probation, which is to say the release of somebody under supervision usually after they've been convicted of a crime, has increased 57% since 79. So in 7 years, it's gone up over 50% And there are over 1,700,000, mostly men, on probation in the United States today. In that same six-year period, parole has gone up 23%. 270,000 men are on parole. And the total number of people in prison since 79 has gone up 48%. So that currently in the United States, we have more people incarcerated behind bars than ever before in our history, both as a total number and as a percentage of the population. And that if you put together the people on probation, people on parole, and the people in prison, about one in every 35 men in the United States is in that status of probation, parole, or in prison. To make it even, to bring, so we've gotten tougher in the last 7 or 8 years. We've increased the number of people that are in prison punished in one of these other ways. And we've also spent a lot of money. Just hang on to your pocketbooks. Of course, nobody carries them at Holden, so you don't have to worry about it. But in 1984, the states, not the federal government, not the counties, just the states, spent $7.2 billion on prisons, with another $1.2 billion spent on new construction. So that's $8.5 billion in 1 year to house the 463,000 people in that category. There are 58,000 new beds under construction as we speak. That's to say, we're building more prisons to put all these people that are going up in all these figures. The states, this is one to remember to take home for when you get back to your hometown. The states will need to provide 1,000 new beds each week to keep up with the increase in the prison population in the United States. So if it keeps going up at about this rate of about 8 or 9% a year, and it won't keep going up forever and ever, but if it keeps going in this trend for the near future, they will need to build 1,000 new beds each week to keep up with the increase. So getting tough costs us lots of money. And whether getting tough makes a dent on some of these other figures is difficult to say. There is some good news in this. And I know I'm throwing some statistics at you, but I think it's worth getting a feel for some of the changes that have gone on. If you look at the number of people that are admitted to prisons, okay, as a function of the number of crimes reported to the police. In other words, you can't expect the cops to find them if it's not reported, but if you look at the ratio of this number to this number, in 1960, for every 100 crimes that were reported to the police, 6.3 people went to prison. So this number would be, the ratio here would be, this is about 1 to 3 now, and the figures I got up here, so 25 years ago, it was about 1 to 6. 1970, it was 2.3, so it got worse. Again, this is about 3 to 1, so it was worse than this 15 years ago. 1983, it was 4. So for every 100 reported crimes, there were 4 guys in jail. So it got a little bit better. So all that money, that $9 billion and that 1,000 new beds a week, in some way can make us feel a little better, because we went from 2 to 4, the ratio of people in prison to reported crime. Yeah?
When you talk about reported crimes, is there any way of telling what percentage of those crimes the number of people who went to prison cleared from the books?
We've talked about that a little bit as we've gone along. Sometimes after somebody is caught, they will plead guilty to having done lots of different crimes. So often, quite a few crimes can be occasionally cleared but with one perpetrator. And there are what we call in the business predatory offenders, which are people that do lots of this stuff, so they can count for quite a few crimes. So that has some effect on, you know, how well we do at that ratio.
Is the 1%, is that 1% at the bottom there?
Yeah, that's 1% of the total number of crimes ended with somebody. And we have talked, we've discussed.
And that's crimes, not people.
That's right.
Okay.
So even though there's some improvement, we're talking about going from 2% to 4%, and maybe if we're lucky, by the time we can get to the good old days of 1960, it'll be 6%. That's pretty dreary, and it's also pretty expensive. And when we talk about the lack of information that goes on that the police have, the constraints that operate in the court, which some of us were talking a little bit about after class, plus this tremendous gap between the amount of crimes that are committed and the amount that are reported, working on increasing this number down here seems a pretty dreary idea. And one of the things that I want to talk about tonight with you is, instead of thinking about this number, starting to think about this number. What happens when you look at the academics and the scholars and the researchers that are in this business, and I count myself as one of those people, a huge amount of their time has been spent with these people. Because what we like to do is observe people that do the bad stuff we're interested in and try to figure out what it is about them that accounts for the way they behave. Was it poor upbringing? Is it something genetic? Does it have to do with income and opportunity? There are as many different theories as there are academics around proposing them. And over the last 50 years, I mean, we could probably reinvent every one of them as we go around the room saying, well, I know what causes crime. It's bad parenting. Or I know what causes crime. It's hanging out with the wrong kids. Every one of those has a theory with lots of books and everybody dwelling on that. The dilemma is those theories haven't helped us very much to make a dent in the problem. The theories have all been, by and large, based on these guys that get caught. And then trying to figure out, by talking to them, something about them, something about their motivation, something about their values, something about the way they think, something about the opportunities they have that'll account for all this bad stuff that they've done. And those theories, just between us, haven't amounted to much. I mean, it's my business, that's what I do for a living, and I teach them and I try to improve them myself. But when you try to think about why people do bad stuff and then use that to try to think about reducing crime, we haven't gotten very far. And I mentioned to you before that one of the most important reasons we have now for thinking about why crime is getting a little bit better has to do with the fact that there are just fewer kids around. So when you look at the national figures, it may be that these demographic changes, the changes in the number of kids 15 to 25, just reduces the pool from which offenders come. So, instead of looking down here, which is what the academics have wanted us to do, and which is what the criminal justice system wants us to do, because they basically are saying, look, if you gave us more money for the police, if you gave us more money for the courts, if you give us more money for the prisons, like the $8 billion, we can do something about the crime problem, because we're the professionals. We're the guys that know how to handle it, and we're the guys that society has given the responsibility for tackling the job. And we, as a society, have bought that. And I mentioned at the end of last time that you could think it's a little bit like medicine. It's a little bit like thinking about what keeps you healthy. And if we went around the room and talked about health, you'd say, well, a good doctor, and I'd say yes. And then you'd say, well, also what you eat, and I'd say yes. And then you'd say, well, also how you take care of yourself. And I'd say, well, that's a good point too. And then you'd say, well, you also need to have certain kinds of resources, the money to buy good food, to live in an area where the environment's clean, to be able to go in for checkups every once in a while to do preventive stuff. so that we've got habits and resources and environment that are also a part of health. And what I'm going to propose to you tonight, and it's something that I want you to try to, for us to try to talk about a little bit, is let's think a little bit about that way about crime. For sure, we need the criminal justice system. No doubt about it. There used to be a bumper sticker when I was a kid that said, if you don't like cops, call a hippie the next time you're in trouble, or something like that. So we're certainly saying that we certainly need the police, and they're certainly an important aspect of what goes on. But let's look above this point, and let's think about the things that make us nervous and produce crimes, and what we can do in order to alleviate that. Now, one of the keys to this is to wrap your mind around a different way of thinking about crime. This old way of thinking about crime starts you out with what motivates the offender, what motivates that guy to do that bad thing, and there are all sorts of theories about it. I want to start thinking about crime by thinking about it as an event, okay? Now, an event takes three things to tango. It takes somebody that causes the event, what we laughingly call the offender. It takes somebody that the event happens to, the victim. And it takes an environment that produces the event, that makes it allowable. And if we think about crime as an event, as we say in the business, a victimization event, and we think about the things that we might be able to do to reduce the number of those events in our lives, then your mind starts to cook a little bit. And it especially starts to cook a little bit if you start thinking about, instead of worrying about what's in the newspaper in terms of crimes that you're worried about, worry about what's in your life that concerns you. Think back to your own neighborhoods and your own communities. And if I say to you, what's the crime problem in your community, you're going to start to think about it a little differently, because you're going to have, I mean, most of you come from real nice places, so it's going to take you a minute to come up with what that problem is. But if we begin there, if we begin with that crime event, and we try to think through, for whom is it a problem in your neighborhood? Is it just something that's a particular problem of yours, or is it something that the whole community is worried about? And then think about what we can do about it. We can begin to reduce this number by not letting it happen in the places where it's happening is having a bad effect on people there. We can think about crime as part of your environment that you want to change. And the way you change it, I've gone to 100 meetings of groups, not sitting out in Holden, but sitting in different communities across the country. And the first thing everybody says is more cops. If we started with somebody and I said, Jane, think about your neighborhood, what's the most important, what's the worst crime problem there? What would you say?
I would say dirt.
Okay. And then let's say we're all from the same neighborhood, we chat about it for a while and see whether we all agree on it. I say, well, what should we do about it? And most people would say, well, we need more police. If there were more police, then we could stop it. So we invite the community relations officer from the local district over, and he'd, hopefully he'd be nice and wouldn't feel threatened by us asking him about it. And then if he was smart, he would see whether they could make some manpower shifts so there'd be a little more police in your neighborhood. But sooner or later that's going to end, because there's going to be a call from some other part of the city. It's not going to have much influence. Remember, burglary is one of our crimes where there's almost no information that the police have to work with once the crime's committed. But then I'd say to Jane, well, who do you think is causing the crimes, the burglaries? Do you think it's kids from the neighborhood, or do you think it's people from outside?
Kids outside.
And then we'd say, well, now what could we do so that we could reduce the possibility? Let's assume that you had a good handle on it, and that's a good assessment of what's going on. Then we would say to ourselves, well, what could we do to reduce the opportunities for those kids from outside to do something bad? And the first thing you have to do is know an inside kid from an outside kid, which is not always easy. So you'd have to work out some way to get to know the kids in your neighborhood a little bit better. And even more important, you'd have to begin to think seriously about keeping your eye out. You know, if people are staying home during the day, to keep an eye on the street and see if there's somebody strange in the neighborhood that you don't recognize, to call the police, to go outside and just make your presence known, to call your neighbor. There are plenty of things that you can do on your own, and burglary is a good example, where increased awareness and increased observation would help. 42% of all the burglaries in the United States happen without forced entry. That is to say, they walk in the front door, they go in a window you left open, they don't kick in or break anything. So another simple and, now that I say it, obvious thing to do is lock your doors and windows when you leave. Well, that sounds commonsensical, but if it's a real problem in the neighborhood and there is some discussion about it, then there may be an interest in actually doing that. Or getting good locks. You know, you go talk to the local hardware store guy and you say, listen, Ralph, if I can bring you in 50 orders for deadbolt locks, can you give us a break on what it would cost? And Ralph, being a shrewd guy, would probably say, sure, that sounds perfectly reasonable. I'll make a little bit less on the 50 locks and we can work something out. So the locks get better. The people watch more. They take a little bit more precaution. Maybe the crime rate goes down. Even if it doesn't, doing something about the problem together helps the community. All of a sudden, you know who the kids are in the neighborhood. They're not, and you know who their parents are. And that's the beginning of feeling a little more comfortable with them. You talk to the neighbors a little bit more because they're giving out the locks and it's at somebody's home and people are having a cup of coffee. And there's a little more sense of community than there was before. Those things add up, coupled with the police. Because if the police, depends of course on what the police chief is like and how they feel about this kind of stuff, but more and more the police departments are delighted to see this kind of thing going on. And if you make it clear to them that you're taking these precautions and that you're particularly concerned about burglary, and their statistics, right, show that it's a reasonable thing to be worried about in your community, then they may very well join in a partnership on it. And they may very well say, well, if a call comes in from your community, we're going to treat it a little bit differently the next month. And if a bunch of calls come in, and that's often what communities do on these burglary things, is if somebody sees a kid climbing over a fence, not only do they call the cops, but they're called phone trees. They call the next person on the phone tree, and they say, Martha, call the police. I just saw somebody go into George's yard. Martha picks up the phone. Mary picks up the phone. Ralph picks up the phone. All of a sudden, the cops have 10 calls from the neighborhood that something's going on. They like that. And they like the fact that you're working together in a partnership in order to do something about the crime problem. I don't promise you that that lowers that rate, because how you count these things is tricky. And if more people are calling, then it looks like the reported crimes are going up. But you know in your neighborhood that you're making a difference. Now, let's take somebody else. What's the crime problem in your community? I mean, think of it in your terms, not my terms. I mean, when I say crime, what do you think of in your neighborhood? Let's have something besides burglary. What else comes up?
Assault happens in our neighborhood. people get followed home from corner grocery stores, and then they're attacked as they exit their car and try to enter their house. People have been on ladders working, repairing their homes, and people have climbed up the ladder and ripped their pant pocket and taken their wallet and pulled them off the ladder and run off.
That's a little strange.
It's big.
Where do you live?
I live in northeast Portland.
Hmm. What kind of community is it?
Socially, economically, it's on the lower end of the middle half to the upper end of the lower half, and it's racially a mixed neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
I know about that because I was assaulted in my driveway as my daughter and I exited our car.
Somebody took your pocketbook and...
Uh-huh. Slugged me in the face and ran off.
During the day?
Uh-huh. Broad daylight. But I'm not the only person that has happened.
Okay, but
it's happened a number of times in my...
Tell us about the kid. What was the... Did you recognize him?
Oh, he's not a kid, yeah. We, my daughter and I identified him and went to court about it and are scheduled to do so again. We went to the grand jury. This person... I don't know how old he is. I would venture to say he's probably 30, give or take. He and his two cousins are known in the neighborhood for doing this. And the police, I think the night that this happened to us, and we were explaining to the police officer what this fellow looked like, the police officer, I think, knew then who he was.
Mm-hmm.
My neighbor had run out at my daughter screaming and chased after the fellow and saw the getaway car and got a license number, so we had that to go on. Plus, this fellow had been like here and had spoken to me and my daughter, so we really got a good look at him and could talk about what he looked like.
And you called the police right away, so they were there.
My daughter was on the phone immediately.
Right, we were talking about that.
And a couple of nights, probably 10 or 12 nights after it happened, a police lieutenant called and wanted to know if he could come to the house. He had some pictures he wanted to show me. And I picked him out of those pictures. And then at that point, the officer told me that this fellow and his two cousins had been perpetrating this crime through the neighborhood. And
you may have solved that one already.
We hope so.
Yeah.
They had two other cases that they took about these three people.
Did he live nearby, this guy? I mean, within a close...
I didn't ask.
Didn't know?
You don't want to know.
I didn't want to know. And I didn't find out his name for quite a long time. I really wasn't interested.
Right.
I lived in that neighborhood, and I figured he did, too, and I didn't want to know who his cousins were. You know?
Right. I mean, it's scary enough to have to go through all...
Yeah. It really is.
That's
a crime that happens
right.
Not only once in our neighborhood. It has happened a number of times.
Right. And there,
we have some things that we've done too.
Well, tell us about it.
One of the things is that I don't drive in that driveway the same way anymore. I don't nose in. I back in the driveway. I don't go in with bundles of groceries and my purse hanging on my arm, struggling to get my key out of my pocket. I park on the, if I have packages, I park on the street. I go in the front door, not the back door. I enter the house, and I leave my packages. Wait for the street to clear, and then go back to get them. It's a hell of a way to live, isn't it?
Yeah,
I can't believe it.
We watch out for our neighbors. I mean, if Bonnie comes home across the street and Jerry's not there, then she might holler out to me, and I'll stand on the porch and watch her go in her house.
I mean, you're talking exactly about the kinds of things that you can do. And often if there's a community organization or a church or a PTA or some organizational unit that can facilitate this kind of stuff happening, it's hugely important to these kinds of endeavors. Because the neighborhood, I mean, you were just mentioning the kind of things that, precautions you've done, and those are exactly the kinds of things that I would recommend too, or going to the grocery with somebody.
I might add that in about 6 weeks' time in our neighborhood, we had 15 house burglaries.
Right.
Daytime, nighttime, people home, people not home, dogs not home. Forced entry, apparently easy entry. It didn't matter. Didn't matter.
Is the...
But it, we got a block meeting. We made a map. We made a telephone tree. I basically knew all the people, but all the people didn't know everybody else. So we got to know each other.
Right.
We found out who lived in what house. It made a difference. It was a hard lesson to learn.
Is there a racial dimension to the problem?
In the burglaries, that's hard to tell.
Yeah, I was thinking about the kid that, or the man that hit you.
The man that attacked me was black, mm-hmm. as are his cousins. My daughter and I saw a house entered at 7:30 one morning. Those were two black men. A house kitty corner from us was entered one evening.
Is your area all white or is it mixed?
Our street is basically a white street. There's one black couple on, or one black lady on the corner.
Mm-hmm.
The house that was seen being entered was entered by a white person. So the rest of the burglaries,
yeah.
no way to know.
Because one of the other elements in this kind of an approach is that often crime problems, and this is sort of an example of it, have either a racial or a generational conflict built into them. There will be conflict between the older people and the younger people in a neighborhood, especially as perceived, well, perceived both ways, but especially as perceived by the older people. The kids are too noisy, they're running up and down the streets, somebody's purse gets grabbed, somebody gets knocked over, they don't have any respect. That kind of a scenario that builds, that weaves itself into a crime, those are problems in themselves, and there also can be crime aspects of that. The racial thing is obvious. The neighborhood changes, doesn't have to be just black and white, but Asian and white and all sorts of other kinds of mixtures. There's a lot of suspicion, there's a lot of misunderstanding. Often people will come in who will be black in this particular instance, who will have a more criminal kind of way of behaving. The interesting and important thing about that is that the black people in the neighborhood are just as worried and just as scared and just as threatened by the activity as the whites are. And one of the tricks in something like this is to get at the root of the conflict as a community and begin to let blacks and whites talk to each other who are equally as scared, equally as vulnerable, and work out ways to resolve the things. And one of the nice things that happens when you do that is that you find out how much you share, even though the skins are a different color, in terms of the things that you want to get rid of, namely kids that, I keep saying kids, people that do the kinds of stuff that that you were just alluding to. So there are ways to tackle direct crime problems like this, and also ways to build community that are tremendously satisfying, not only because they can reduce the crime problem, but also because they start to weave a neighborhood or a community together. Churches can play a hugely important role in this, as can community organizations. One of the common ways that this kind of activity will get started is that people will be afraid to go to church, or something will happen on the way to church, or on the way to the PTA, or on the way to the Moose or the Elks or whatever. And then if that organization is smart, it will pick up and begin to work on the crime problem itself. This is all called, just naming things, community crime prevention. Notice what it starts with. It starts with your definition. Not the policeman's, not the academics, not the newspapers, your definition. So the citizen decides what the problem is. Now this is no easy matter, because if we were sitting in Portland in a neighborhood, there'd be lots of different notions of what the problem is. Somebody would say, there's a bar on the corner. The problem is it's open too late at night. It brings all sorts of riffraff into the community. Somebody else would say, I just got punched in the mouth by some maniac, and that's the problem. Somebody would say, there's too much litter. Somebody would say, the kids don't have a place to play. That kind of definitional problems is in some ways a plus, because what the community then has to do, or the organization has to do, is it's got to work together to figure out which one it wants to start with, which one is the one that brings the community together and is the most important, and what are the other ones that it wants to work on. So even though there may be dissension, citizen decides, over what it is, you begin with your notion of what you want to work on, not somebody else's. And you begin with your experience in terms of the basis of what you want to pursue. And I can't tell you how important that is in our society, because so very often, you're always reacting. You're always reacting to what somebody else is telling you is your problem, you know, whether it's the newscaster or somebody else telling you what the problem is. There are all sorts of neat ways to do this a little more systematically. I mean, you can do it with a bunch of people in a room. You can get the local university to do a survey in the area. Not expensive. Often they have courses where they want to do this. They can either, you know, or the community group itself can do a survey. Very simple kind of thing. Tell me what you think the problems are in the neighborhood. What's the most important? So forth and so on. So it's democratic. And it's experiential. And second of all, this is a little bit of a fancy word for it, it's actionable, by which I mean we've talked about the five or six things that we can do. It's not, I mean, with all due respect to Rose Byrd. I mean, so many of the other things, I'm thinking of a conversation that we had, so many of the other things about crime take you 15, 20 steps to get to it. You know, you want to call the police department. You get put on hold 86 times. You want it, so you write a letter to the newspaper, or you get involved in recalling a judge, or you do something that's terribly distant and takes lots of other people reacting to you before you can have some kind of impact. The kinds of things we've been talking about are actionable in the sense that a group of people together can do lots of them. They can do them individually in terms of the changes you made and how you shop, or they can do them collectively around groups doing things together. The third important thing about it is this is not a great word, but let's call it communal. That is to say, not only do citizens decide, not only is something that you can work on, but it draws people together. And it also draws you together with these guys down here in a collaborative kind of partnership. So much of the time, whether it's the police or the courts or the prisons, somebody's attacking them. They're saying, you no good, blah, 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 you're not doing this, you're not doing that. And so much of the mentality inside the criminal justice system is a kind of us and them mentality. The civilians out there don't really understand. They're heckling us because for political reasons. They're doing it because they're opportunistic. They don't really have all the facts. Often the criminal justice system is on the defensive most of the time, whether it's the newspapers, whether it's a citizens group. Things get politicized very, very quickly in this situation. That can happen, but it doesn't start there. It starts with the idea that you and the police together can do something about it. One of the kinds of things in a case like that is one of the things that other communities have done is when somebody's sitting sort of out on a limb, like you will be when you go to testify, other people go with them. Mm-hmm.
Community people have already, we have community groups, and they've already offered to go.
I mean,
it's not the first time that that would have happened.
I mean, not only is it going to make you feel better, but all of a sudden the judge is going to kind of notice that there are all these nice faces out there that weren't there before that want to know what he's going to do with this guy.
When did that happen to you? How long ago?
It happened the Monday after Easter.
So how many months now then?
Three.
Wow. That ain't swift justice, is it?
No, but I'm
trial's already been postponed twice.
That's a common tactic. I mean, they're hoping that you'll go away or get tired of it.
He may never go to trial, you know. I mean, I'm not Pollyanna about that. He may never go to trial. But we'll see.
But it's communal. It's not only communal in terms of the neighborhood, it's communal in terms of the way you can relate to the criminal justice system. Now, don't get me wrong. It can turn political very fast. If you've got a police department that turns its back on what you're interested in, maybe pressure's the only thing that they can understand. But it doesn't start that way. It starts with a common definition of a problem, something that you want to do something about, and the offer of a partnership in order to do it. Now, so we're up here on this group, and we're working at a very local level, thinking about how to get this number down for the things that you care about. And that's going to be a broad range of things. Often in poor neighborhoods, conversations like this turn into things about recreational facilities for the kids, about abandoned buildings, about open lots where there's garbage, about all sorts of areas that breed crime or breed deterioration in the minds of the people that live there. Some of the graffiti is another example. Some of these things are not what you conventionally call a crime. I mean, they're not in your common definition of a crime. That's something that's against the law, that is against a person or property. But they have a tremendously negative effect on the neighborhood. You know, here's this building sitting there. It's been empty for 15 years. There's been a fire in it. Vagrants sleep in it. Kids fool around in it. Rumor has it there's drug traffic in it. That's a crime problem. And that's something that the citizens have decided to do something about. It's actionable, and it's communal. Except it doesn't take you to the police department. It takes you to housing court. And it takes you to the city attorney and saying, let's get this thing knocked down. And you can do something about that. The kids are another hugely important piece of this. Not with this group, because we all come from nice areas, but lots of times the crime problem's inside the neighborhood. It's coming from kids, often you may even know who they are, who are kind of wild and out of control or just sort of notorious for being bad eggs in the area, or the people in the community are very worried about their own kids. There's not enough for them to do. There isn't recreational activity. There isn't summer programs. There aren't jobs. That's a crime problem. And that's a crime problem that comes, again, out of the definition that the citizens make in that area. And it leads to a variety of different kinds of issues. Some of the things they can do themselves, you know. Some of the things they have to call upon the city government or some other government to spur action on. But they're doable. They're democratic and they're communal. And it's a way to reduce not only the amount of crime, which I'm always a fan of, but also the amount of fear. You'd be surprised how much better you feel in the process of dealing with these kinds of problems. Because you're sharing a concern and you're finding other people that share it, and you can reduce that concern by working on it. Now, it doesn't, I don't want to oversell what we're talking about here. I mean, sometimes, it's something that's not easily solved. But the building of the camaraderie and the building of the capacity to identify the problem and work on it makes the whole crime issue something that's manageable, something that is not just for the professionals, but it's something for the people too. It's also, in the same way that I was mentioning about health, it's also something that's a function of habit and resources and environment. Those are all things that you can improve by working together on these crime issues. And that's a new way to think about it. I mean, it's not, I mean, your neighborhood's already, it's new compared to this usual way of worrying about offenders and why they do the terrible stuff. Now you're worrying about how not to be a victim and how to build up the capacity by what you do and what you do to the offender and how you change that environment to make that victimization not happen.
Yeah. Just to add something, at least from my experience, I work in the juvenile court in Snohomish County here in Washington, and it's amazing. We've had a number of areas that have done the Black Watch concept, and it's amazing how quickly word gets around that this area is not a good area to break into. And our what we're attempting to do is to work. You know, if you can get the whole area blanketed, that's obviously, otherwise it does have a tendency to push it. The other thing that I guess as a question to you, Dan, is one of the things that we run into, a major issue, is the relationship between drugs and alcohol and the juvenile crime problem, in that like somewhere between 75-80% of all the juvenile crimes that are committed are somehow related to either juveniles who have been drinking and commit the crime then, or they're committing the crime in order to get money or alcohol. Any comments on that in terms of the impact that this type of program would have?
The same things that I just would put in sort of commonsensical kinds of things, where you could try to control the distribution of those things in the neighborhood to the kids. Is one thing, and then the other kind of thing is that there was a neighborhood that we studied in Philadelphia, where the group knew who the drug pushers were in the community. It was clear who was selling the kids the drugs. There was actually a house where these people lived, and they went and picketed the house and made such a stink, got the media there and stuff, that the people left town, that at least left that community very fast. I'm less confident about the other side, but there's also things you can do educationally with the kids around the alcohol and its use. But that's a tough road to hoe when you're talking about the peer pressure that's coming from the other. I'm not saying you shouldn't, I'm just saying I'm not overwhelmed with sort of formal efforts to do that and how well they work.
What's your perception that I think what's going to happen as this gets going, and it seems to be getting some real good movement in the communities, and the numbers of arrests have actually increased, at least in our area, because of that. You have that quicker response. You see someone go over the fence, bam, the phone call's made, and the police respond and actually catching more of the kids in any way in the act. That has absolutely inundated the court system. And part of the problem and part of the anger is you increase the system in any one place, and it kills it in the other.
Right.
So that at the court now, we're not able to get them through, and so more cases are slipping through because of the timeline, and victims are extremely angry, and we keep saying, talk to the legislature. I think for just so that people are aware that if you impact the system on any point, it's going to also impact the other parts.
The point about the legislature is an important one. Most of the time when the juvenile justice system goes to the legislature, it goes by itself. It trots up and it says, we need 15% more money, and the legislators sort of yawn, and there's no political pressure other than the pressure that the bureaucracy can bring on the legislatures. If this thing percolates in the way that we're talking about it, there's a natural constituency there that's saying, we better be doing something at these other levels too in order to improve the situation. It also kicks back. It does increase the reporting, it's supposed to. But hopefully it's also going to reduce the crime. I mean, there's going to be less of it, even if the figures, you have to be careful about the figures for a while. But you'll know in your own neighborhood that there's been some improvement. It takes some work. This is not an easy thing. But it makes crime, like health, something that the citizen is the most important part of, and not just something that's done to them by somebody on the outside. And it breaks down some of the alienation that we all feel about the crime problem. I mean, it's always happening. It's always something that's out of our control. And this isn't out of our control. I mean, terrible things do happen. You know, people get diseases that they never dreamed of, and they die. And people get victimized in terrible ways, even when they have block watches. Nobody's saying this is a panacea. But it's a way of empowering and communalizing an issue for the last 50 years hasn't been that way, and that we feel it's out of our control, and this is a way to bring it back in.
One other thing in support of that, too, is that if you think that, at least for the juveniles in our jurisdiction, about 15% of the kids commit over 70% of the total crimes that come through the court, so that you can, if you're talking about 100% of the crimes, you're talking about a relatively small number of people that are actually committing those crimes. And if you can begin to have greater watch and be able to, greater impact, and juveniles in particular, that's a lot different from the adult system. You catch a juvenile, and if he's been committing a large number of burglaries, it's likely that those are all going to come spilling out, and that at least, we're a relatively naive area, I suppose. It's not the same as some of the larger urban areas where kids are behaviorally at least more like adults in terms of, hey, you got me on this one, but that's it. There's no more talking.
It's also interesting to think about this in terms of a theme for the summer. I mean, this is not, this is preventative. It's not retributional. It is communal. It's bringing people together, not isolating and sort of stoning them. Obviously, people are going to be punished if they do bad things, but the punishment isn't going to come out of some anonymous system where it's kind of a roll of the dice whether you end up here or not. It's now coming out of a community that's saying no. And I'm not quite sure. It's gentle compared to the other more severe ways of talking because it stops things before they happen. And it brings people together to deal with them with a common voice rather than the voice of, a bureaucrat or a court official 6, 8, 10 months away saying something to the person. So it offers a way to think about crime that's harmonizing. Rather than divisive. It still is serious. I mean, it's still about justice. It's still about punishment, and it's still about just rewards for what you're doing. But it's doing it by drawing people together for the common good rather than letting it happen here in the kind of bureaucratic, anonymous way that it often happens within the system. So I think it's worth your consideration, and
How about this armed neighborhood watch? I've heard about that in Germany, that this is becomes legal now, and that it's becoming more and more popular that people of your neighborhood just drive around their cars being armed.
Yeah, I've seen newspapers. I've studied this stuff a good deal.
I consider this really very dangerous too.
They're not armed with guns. They're armed with walkie-talkies, not with guns.
Oh, really?
They have walkie-talkies, and when they see something, they're supposed to immediately report it to the police.
Right. That's the one. CB patrols, that's always a possibility. I haven't seen very much of it.
I think one of the things that happens is when these things are talked about and put on the board, when people give it an honest try and see that those things don't make the impact that they hoped that they would, they get frustrated, and then in my neighborhood, vigilantism is talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And that's more frightening almost
Right.
than someone kicking down my back door.
Well, Dan, another thing too is, why don't you change some of the rules as far as lawyers getting and getting continuances continually and trying to wear down a witness?
Well,
do you know something about that?
I'm not, I mean, I think some people try. What I'm saying is that's a very tough thing for somebody outside the legal system to have much effect on. And this is something that you can't have an effect on. We've got to stop, so we'll talk again on Saturday, and thanks for coming.
Good.